now with over 25 years of experience integrating mental health and spirituality, the author of Reclaiming Authenticity, When Ancestors Weep, and Redeeming the Bereaved. Here is Dr. James Hauck.
Right. Good evening, everybody, wherever you are in the world at this time. Welcome to Reclaiming Authenticity, finding one's courage to reclaim that which has always been in you, what you always have been, and remembering who you truly are as a soul. Very happy to be with you here tonight, every other Wednesday evening at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 6 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. I'm Dr. James Hauck, and if you would like more information about me, or to leave me your comments about today's show, I just ask that you would visit that website. It is www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity. That's www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity. And if you would like to be part of the show or have any questions that you want to, just pop on the show tonight, just invite you to call in the toll-free line. It's 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. And just in case you cannot spend the entire hour with me this evening, No worries. These broadcasts are now podcasted in case you want to go back and listen again, or you can go back into the archives and listen to previous shows. So, what does it mean to reclaim what has always been in you, or what you always have been, and remember who you truly are as a soul? Well, basically, it means that I have a solid belief that all of us come into this world already equipped and graced with everything we need for in this life in terms of our skills, our talents, our strengths, our character traits, our giftedness, and how we live out our giftedness is always in and through various relationships. And this aspect is very important when considering who we truly are. Because although we may have similar gifts, or we may have similar skills or talents or strengths or character traits, no two people express them identically. In other words, each of us have a thisness about us that cannot be duplicated. So, people can try and imitate how we do things, but no one can duplicate us. Because within us lies what the 12th century scholar John Duns Scotus referred to as hetchery, a thisness, a uniqueness, if you will. This is something, kind of abstract, but I always have fun trying to explain it to kids, because I usually break it down into the image of a thumbprint. Something that we all have. We all have a thumbprint, but no two are alike. And so, therefore, everybody's thumbprint is unique to them. Or another way I can explain it to kids, especially smaller kids, is that we live in an echo, that whatever we send out in terms of our thoughts or our words or our actions will come back to us in the same manner from which it went out from us. Sort of like an echo. It could be in a cave, or we could be in a tunnel, and we would shout, "Hello!" And then, of course, we would hear our voice echoing back to us. Same principle regarding our uniqueness. So indeed, what we send out does come back to us. And the importance of this realization of who we truly are. And I'll be sharing stories that illustrate this concept. Now, unfortunately, millions of people have never had a chance to discover their uniqueness because societies often tell us to look in all the wrong places. In other words, look externally instead of looking from, or to within or from within. Look at for that thisness in the externals of life or the accumulation of things. or the accomplishments or the accolades. But this is not where our thisness, our uniqueness and hecheity are to be found. Instead, the full expression of who we are is to be found with our deep realization and our full experiences as souls. You know, not just the, let's say, the head knowledge of this, but to be so transformed by that experience, firsthand experience, we see ourselves as a soul and we love ourselves as a soul. And we are so transformed by that, that we live it out every day in and through relationships. Because when you think about it, speaking of relationships, you know, we often receive our deepest physical and emotional and psychological, even spiritual wounds in human relationships. And moreover, we may go along in life and maybe some due to some unpleasant experiences, we may feel that we need to hide our hecheity, hide our uniqueness, hide our giftedness, such as when we give up and give in to the labels and stereotypes that others want us to be for them, so they feel good about themselves. Or we may feel as though we have no choice but to push our giftedness and our skills way down so that others cannot see it and therefore exploit it, or whatever other detrimental thoughts or behaviors that might come our way. And also, perhaps, you know, growing up, maybe we were told that we would never amount to anything, or whatever other voice that we may have heard telling us that there's really nothing special to us. So maybe we just stopped looking from or looking to within. And ironically, about these relationships, they just might be within our own families or our coworkers or institutions, and they might even be amongst our friends. Because we assume that the people who are, let's say, supposed to love us the most just might have been the ones who have hurt us because of their unhealed wounds and their underdeveloped selves. But still, all's not lost, because there is power in seeking healing and inner transformation and this direct realization of ourselves as a soul. Because when we transform, and trust me, when you have this direct realization of yourself as a soul, it is a powerful transformation. So when that occurs, we do transform, but we also transform others by our presence, our grace, and our understanding, because we are forever expanding in our awareness, and it gets played out in relationships. But, you know, first and foremost, forgiveness and kindness and compassion begin with how we treat ourselves, because when we are compassionate with ourselves, we then can become more compassionate with others. And when we are forgiving with ourselves, we then can be more forgiving with others. And when we're able to live in gratitude with ourselves, we then discover how this really opens up our hearts to see and to live in gratitude with others. And when we are able to truly know ourselves as a soul and live from our soul, it opens us up to understand the potential in others to see themselves as a soul. So all in all, transformation does begin with us. It's a transformation of awareness, and we are ever expanding on our awareness. Or, as I was reading earlier today in one of the Upanishads, it states this: it's true that the body is perishable, but within it dwells the imperishable self, that is the soul. This body is subject to pleasure and pain, and no one who identifies with the body can escape from pleasure and pain. But those who know that they are not the body pass beyond pleasure and pain to live in abiding joy. And like the wind, like the clouds, like thunder, like lightning, which rise from space without physical shape and reach the transcendent light in their own form, those who rise above body consciousness ascend to the transcendent light in their real form, the self. And really, this is what reclaiming authenticity is all about. And actually, it can be summed up in one word, namaste, which roughly translated means, because I see myself as a soul of light, this allows me to greet your lighted soul, who you are, even if you don't see it in yourself. Well, how is your heart today? I hope your heart is well. I hope you are well. I hope that even if you are struggling today, that you'll be able to find rest and comfort and the peace you need. And, you know, if you've been listening to these shows for some time, you may ask yourself, why do I always ask about your hearts? Well, there's a simple explanation for this, because I am a fan of the HeartMath Institute. And according to the researchers at the HeartMath Institute, the more traditional way of studying the communication pathways between the head and the heart has eventually led scientists to focus primarily on the heart's response to the brain's instructions. However, they've discovered that the communication between the heart and the brain is actually a great dynamic going on, this two-way dialogue with each, you know, the head and the brain, or I'm sorry, the heart and the brain, continuously influencing one another's function. So, for example, research that they have done here has shown that the heart communicates to the brain in four major ways. You know, there's neurologically, you know, through the transmission of nerve impulses. And the heart communicates to the brain biochemically via hormones and neurotransmitters. And it also communicates with the brain biophysically, you know, through pressure waves and so forth. And energetically through electromagnetic field interactions. And communication along these four different channels significantly affects the brain's activities. And in fact, the HeartMath researchers have shown that messages the heart sends to the brain can also affect performance. So, all in all, listen to your hearts. They have a lot to say. Well, welcome to the last day of the month of July, and it's, I don't know about you, but it's been an interesting month, to say the least. A lot of things going on in just the month of July. A lot of people are looking forward to August, hoping that things will calm down, but I don't think so. I think we're in for a wild ride through the end of the year. So, you know, just an early welcome to August, and may you enjoy the dog days of summer, and if you're outside in the evening, look up into the stars and see if you can locate the dog star, the Sirius, and see if you can find that constellation. Well, as you're looking back on the month of July, let's go a little bit further. Let's look back on the first 7 months of this year, and yes, it has been 7 months. So just a quick reflection, you know, what lessons have you learned so far this year? You know, what insights have you gained in these 7 months? What are some things that you had to let go of, even if you weren't ready to let go of them? And what are some things you still want to take hold of this year? Well, the interesting thing about reflecting on these questions is that they are often better understood and remembered within the context of stories. Yeah, that's right, stories. What is your all-time favorite story? You know, one that you can sit and listen to, or even you would tell over and over again. We all have favorite stories, and it's something about the dynamic of telling and listening to stories that teach us powerful lessons like nothing else. And let's think back to when you were in school. You know, perhaps when you were in school, you learned how to write a story. You know, and the teacher said, well, make sure you include the what, the when, the where, the why, and the how. Or, you know, maybe you learned how to tell stories from the storyteller in the family. And in my family, it is me. That when our kids were smaller, instead of reading them a story, I would always tell them a story, you know, that their minds would connect to, and that they would get all wound up and they wouldn't be able to go to sleep afterwards. And then for some reason, I would get into trouble for that. Like, what do? I just told the kids a story. Of course, you have to act it out too, but not something at 9 o'clock at night when you're trying to get the kids down. But what are you going to do? So whenever you listen to or you read a story, what captures your attention most often? Is it the mental images formed in your mind? Is it the deeper lessons, or let's say the morals that are found within the story? Or perhaps maybe it was the way in which a story was told that created excitement or enthusiasm. And perhaps this is why the Audible app is so popular. There's something so fascinating about hearing a story and being read to us. And this is actually the whole premise behind the movie, The Reader. And The Reader was a movie that came out, first it came out as a book and then later as a movie. It was set in post-World War II Germany as the country attempts to rebuild itself. And this is where teenager Michael Berg meets Hannah Schmitz. And she was a bus conductor and a much older woman. And their relationship is passionate, to say the least. But what makes their relationship so memorable is that she would often ask Michael to read to her because, well, he was still in school and he always had books with him and so forth. And they would always meet after school. And, she's like, read me a story. And he had no idea that she could not read. And their relationship goes on for some time. However, one day comes when Hannah just abruptly moved away. Just moved away one day without informing Michael. Left no forwarding address, just nothing. And he is confused and he's heartbroken. I mean, he really fell hard for Hannah. Yet years later, while he was studying law at Heidelberg University, Michael is appalled to discover that Hannah is on trial for a heinous Nazi war crime. And if you haven't seen the movie or read the book, I'm not going to give away the ending, but I invite you to enjoy the story. It is powerful, and you get this understanding of what does it mean to listen to stories being read to you. Well, back in April of 2020, just on, as the pandemic was kicking off and people didn't know what was going on back then, NPR did a story entitled How Stories Connect and Persuade Us and Unleashing the Brain Power of a Narrative. Well, according to this article, with the benefit of MRI scans, many different areas of the brain light up when someone is listening to a story or, let's say, a narrative. And not just the areas of the brain that are responsible for language processing, but also the neurological circuits also lit up. I mean, for instance, during the more emotional sections of the story, one study found that the neurons responsible for processing emotions arising from sounds were activated. Okay, and that was key. The neurons responsible for processing emotions that came from the sounds, they were activated. So, in other words, as you hear a story unfold, your brain waves start to synchronize with those of the storyteller. You start to connect on, let's say, a psychological, an emotional level. And Dr. Yuri Hassan, professor of psychology and neuroscience at Princeton, he found that as one person told a story and the other person listened, they found that the greater the listener's comprehension, the more closely the brainwave patterns mirrored those of a storyteller, okay? Which I find fascinating. And the brain activity in two people, it's just the brainwave patterns. It just started to mirror. So, in other words, stories stick with us often because of the metaphors people use to tell their stories. Again, the mental images. And we get caught up in stories like nothing else in our lives. Well, when you also think about it, storytelling also helps with learning because stories are easy to remember. Instead of just rote memory of, just maybe that's how you learned your times tables. But when a story is invoked, we remember the stories because of the pictures and the images and the metaphors and so forth. And the organizational psychologist Peg Neuhauser found that learning, which stems from a well-told story, is a story that is remembered more accurately and for far longer than learning simply derived from facts and figures. And psychologist Jerome Bruner's research also suggested that facts, in and of themselves, are 20 times more likely to be remembered if they're part of a story. And I can attest to this, just my own life. I can remember the stories my history teacher told us way back in eighth grade. And whether or not he was talking about the Revolutionary War or the Civil War, he would always place us in the storylines, and his stories would come alive. And it was, you just kind of gave up taking notes and you just put your pencil down and you listened because that's how well he told these stories. Well, let's bring all of this now into the world of mental health, okay? And storytelling is a powerful means of helping people find their healing and their peace that, let's say, they're desperately searching for, because it places their experiences within a context. It's how people find meaning. It's how they make sense out of what they've been through and or are going through presently. Because think about it this way. Everyone I counsel has a story to tell. In fact, every person's life is a story worth telling. And every story worth telling is a story worth listening to. And I've listened to hundreds and hundreds of stories. I've listened to many stories told in, sadness and pain, again, with the metaphors, powerful metaphors. And I've listened to stories told in heartbreak and anger. And I've also listened to many stories that are told from a perspective of joy and hope. And one of the more interesting aspects I've found is that when people tell their story from a place of anger, they typically forget all of the other good things that have occurred in their life. It's almost as if anger produces a form of amnesia, or at least selective amnesia. I mean, all the good and wonderful experiences have been forgotten, almost as if the past emotional and psychological and the physical and the spiritual woundedness is all that can be remembered in the heat of the moment. Pay attention next time. That's when you're angry. Can you think of all the good things that somebody has done for you, the one that you're angry with, and so forth? We can't do it because we're over into our sympathetic nervous system. And that certainly triggers the fight or flight in us. And we're not thinking reflectively when we do that, or when we're in over in the fight or flight mode. We just can't. But after we calm down and we start to shift back over into the parasympathetic, there we go, nervous system, we're able to reflect. We're able to evaluate. We're able to say, okay, maybe that wasn't the best idea, or whatever it might be. We can do that because the anger is gone and we're no longer in fight or flight, but we're calm. We can be reflective. We're resting and we are recovering from all that adrenaline rush. So just pay attention to that next time. Because when people tell their stories from a place of anger, they will forget all the other good things that have occurred in their life. Well, you see, when we get used to telling a story in a certain way, we may tend to forget all the other things that came before us. Okay? It's almost as if it's conveniently erased from the time being. But as we tell our story from a healthier place, this also allows us to connect to the healthier places within ourselves. But what allows us to make this shift? you know, because a shift needs to occur. You know, going from we tell a story over and over again according to a certain way, even maybe even from the same places of, you know, this is where I get angry, or this is where I cry, or this is where I, you know, have like a disappointing tone in my voice. But we can heal from that woundedness, and we start to tell our stories differently. You know, we're telling them from a healthier place in us. But what is this shift that has to occur? Well, author Marianne Williamson states that we can tell how much we've healed from our past because we've forgotten the pain in the memory. Okay? You can tell how much we've healed from the past because we have forgotten about the pain in the memory. We're always going to have the memory, you know, good, bad, positive, negative, okay? It doesn't matter. We'll always have the memory. But when we tell that story, or when we think about that story, do we have the pain still attached to the memory? If we have pain, then we have more healing to do. And it's kind of ironic, you know, we tell our stories from that place of wholeness. We forget the pain, you know, when we tell our stories from a place of wholeness and goodness and health. And yet, when we tell our stories from a place of anger, frustration, confusion, and pain, more than likely we're going to tend to forget all the good that is also part of the story, but our minds will just cancel that out. You know, because, you know, everybody has an authentic voice, and, you know, I'm convinced of it. You know, and where there's a voice, there is sound. And of course, where there is sound, there's vibration. And this is where the healing occurs. This is the shift that occurs. We can change the voice. We can change the vibration. And ultimately, we change the energy. Where there is sound, there is vibration. And where there's vibration, there's energy. And that's what we can change. That's what shifts in us. And, you know, as a counseling educator and a clinician and a pastoral professional, I'm often saddened, you know, by people's beliefs, just that when it comes to addressing their physical, emotional, and spiritual problems, they consider themselves powerless and without a voice. You know, it's just like, I can't do this. I don't have a voice. I cannot express myself. And perhaps this is a result of never feeling valued or never being allowed to use their voice. Well, admittedly, many people are unable to perceive their insights and their strengths, almost as if they cannot see themselves as capable of healing, let alone achieving anything meaningful with their lives. And most of the time, people are content to live for brief moments of joy and celebration, you know, often marked off by transitional milestones of, let's say, baptisms and marriages, birthdays, graduations and promotions, retirements, so on and so forth. And furthermore, when it comes to wrestling with life's questions, you know, many people are often overwhelmed, not only by the concept that the answers they seek often lie within themselves, but also that this belief that inner freedom and peace and joy and unconditional love are all too good to be true. You know, that those things belong to somebody else. I don't deserve those things, or whatever excuse it is. But the human voice has this power because it carries with it the energy of its vibration. And maybe this is perhaps why people who deny the truth can't tolerate those who mention the truth, or at least come from a different perspective. You know, it's just something that they cannot tolerate hearing. Truth is the truth. And here's a good example of what I mean. One of the major psychosocial spiritual obstacles I run into when counseling others occurs when emotionally, or let's say psychologically, wounded people are genuinely frightened and immobilized by their potential for healing and inner growth. Because you see, failure is not the only thing people fear. The idea of finding inner peace and freedom can also be immobilizing. And I'd love to tell this story that to illustrate this point, that I remember working with a woman whose husband died after 35 years of marriage. Indeed, she was truly grief-stricken and clearly struggling with severe depression. And she came to me to kind of help her work through, and she didn't know everything that she was going to get into. But as we continued to work together, the more of her story of pain and loss started to come out. Okay, of course, it was bound to, because I was just asking her, tell me a story. What was your husband like? What are the good moments that you two shared? How in him just being who he was able to pull out of you the very best of who you are, and vice versa. And yet, there was one time that we met when she started to get a glimpse of a healthier life. She started to see herself healing from the pain of this loss, and it scared her. Immediately, he said to me, "Stop, just stop. I can't do this anymore because I feel as though you're going to take away my grief." That's a powerful statement, powerful insight. Now I knew where a statement like that was coming from in her, and not that I could ever take away something that another person wasn't ready to let go of, but when you think about it, she would rather live in her grief and pain, sorrow, than embrace the possibility that she could live a life, all the while being able to hold on to the wonderful memories of her husband. You see, in her mind, if she let go of her grief, she had nothing else to, nothing better to take on. And as a result, her story remained the same. And so did her voice. So did her energy. Well, I would really love to hear how you have found healing through storytelling. So again, if you'd like to call in tonight, that number is 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. And I'll be taking your calls after this break. Again, you are listening to Reclaiming Authenticity, and I'm your host, Dr. James Houck. I'll be back with you in 1 minute. Welcome back. I'm Dr. James Houck, and you are listening to Reclaiming Authenticity. Well, earlier in the broadcast, we talked about a different way to look at how we might find healing when another person wounds us emotionally, or maybe they wound us psychologically, maybe they wound us physically, maybe they even wound us spiritually. And a key piece of healing for us is to perhaps first seek to understand not only how people tell their stories, but also what must have happened in another person's life, or their pain and their suffering, their sorrow, that perpetuates their need to then go and wound others. I mean, you know the old saying just as well as I do, wounded people wound people. Hurt people hurt people. You see that over and over and over again. And admittedly, many people are unable to perceive, these insights and strengths as if they cannot see that they're capable of healing, let alone achieve anything meaningful in their lives. And as a result, Most people are content to just live 9 to 5, with some joys and celebrations, and they have some milestones of, let's say, baptisms or birthdays, marriages, graduations, promotions, retirements, and so forth. Okay. Now, it also, needs to be pointed out that whenever we, everybody has to wrestle with these life questions, and many people are often overwhelmed, not only by the concept that the answers they seek often lie within themselves, but, some people may even have the belief that, when there's talk about the inner freedom and experience joy and peace, and what does it mean to experience unconditional love or to show unconditional love, that these things are all too good to be true, that I can't conceive of these concepts because I've never had these things in my life. Well, that's a story worth telling because, as I'd also been mentioning in the first half of the show, that the human voice has tremendous power because it carries with it the energy of its vibration. This is something that you see down through the decades, the centuries, so down through history, that whenever society or rulers or anybody who wanted to take over or just people in general just wanted to go out there and wound, the first thing that they would want to do to conquer a people is to take away their voice. And this is especially true with women, because the voice is where women hold their strength. They are communicators. They are the storytellers. There's power in their voices because there's power in their vibration. And so down through history, the way to silence women is to take away their voice. But when women get together and they find their voice, they find empowerment. And when they use their voice, stand back, because they're never going to go back into being quiet ever again. You're not going to intimidate them into silence no more. Okay, so the human voice has this power, it has this potential for power, because it carries with it the energy of its vibration. Okay, and this is where, as I was talking about, this is where the transformation occurs. Just like, just a basic physics 101 lesson, that we can never destroy energy, we can transform it. Okay? I mean, that's just a fact. There's just no way you're going to do it. But you can transform the energy into something more powerful, and as well as something that's healing, something that's strong, something that's resilient, and so on and so forth. Okay? And if you were with me right before the break, remember I shared the story of when emotionally or psychologically wounded people can be genuinely frightened and immobilized by their potential for healing and inner growth. Okay. And a lot of people I counsel, they go back and forth, well, is it a fear of failure or is it a fear of success? And what is this fear all about? If you find this inner peace and freedom, you have to let go of the pain. And because you're at that point where you need to take on something better. But then a lot of people get scared at that because they may realize, well, now I got to be responsible. Now I have to redefine my life apart from the pain. I can no longer rely on that. I've used it so long as a crutch or, to gain, secondary gains, sympathy and so forth. You have to let that go because you can't have it both ways. You either begin to walk in that freedom and that inner peace, or you remain where you are. And this is often a process. We just don't go blink, like turning off and on a light. It's a process of healing. Just like forgiveness is a process, so too is healing. It's a process. And again, I shared the most recent story of a woman whose husband died after 35 years of marriage. And of course, married to somebody that long, even longer, you are going to be truly grief stricken and struggling with severe depression, and one of the questions, that we were, kicking around together is, now what is her life going to look like? Because she had relied on him for so long. Now, it was just her and her children. She didn't know what to do because he really took care of her. She didn't, wasn't really empowered. I mean, because he just said, "Don't worry, I'll take care of it." And she did. She didn't worry. But when you get down to asking her, "Who are you?" She truly didn't know. And what she truly wanted to hang on to was her grief, was her pain. And so, even though she was there with me to find healing and to find peace and to find some sort of grief resolution, it just got to be too overwhelming because of what it required her then to do. Now, she just really struggled with not having anything better to take on. And then she just chose to stay where she was. And this is true for us to ask ourselves, just an in our face kind of question that we can't get around, and this what has so wounded ourselves that allows us to continually act out of our woundedness in relationships and yet expect different results. And then we wonder why we don't heal. Well, in a debate with William F. Buckley at Cambridge University, James Baldwin, who was a writer, a playwright, a poet, and an activist, made this remark in his debate, which, by the way, you can pull it up on YouTube. It's a black and white production and very, very powerful. Both sides argued well. But what really captured my attention was when James Baldwin made this statement about people acting out of their woundedness. And he said that Sheriff Clark in Selma, Alabama, he simply cannot be dismissed as a total monster. Well, I'm sure that he loves his wife and he loves his children and he likes to get drunk. Okay. One has to assume that he's a man like me. But he doesn't know what drives him to use a club or to menace others with a gun, or even to use a cattle prod on somebody else. See, something awful must have happened to him as a human being to be able to put a cattle prod against a woman's breast. I mean, what happens to the woman is ghastly, and yet what happens to the man who does it is in some way much, much worse. As I said, you can catch this debate on YouTube. It's about an hour long, but very fascinating. And what James Baldwin was reminding us is that the offender or the oppressor, they often suffer from a greater tragedy of inner pain than perhaps the one who suffers outwardly. And this is a phenomena that I also run into time and time again, counseling clients who want to heal from their past and improve their relationships. That, whatever a person is struggling with from other relationships, more than likely they're struggling with the same issue in themselves. And again, this here's where the echo comes in. What negative energy is being sent out echoes back to us sooner or later. And yet, keep in mind, we can change the voice. We can change the vibration. We can change the energy. And I proposed to, the understanding of self-inflicted wounds are like the vibration of an echo, that the negative energy of what we send out through our thoughts, our words, and our actions, it's going to return to us. It's like we hear the sound of our voice echoing back in our ears when we are in our tunnel. And this energy, unless we transform it through healing our own wounds, it's going to come back to us exactly how it went out from us. And as we explore our painful memories, which, by the way, nobody wants to do, but we need to, because it's going to start to eat us up. But as we explore our painful memories, we often catch a glimpse of what healing and wholeness just might look like for us. And this is a real gift, because when this insight occurs, we may be tempted to resist change or run away from transformation or even sabotage ourselves by falling back into old ways to avoid embracing what thorough healing requires of us, such as, let's say, acknowledging a wrongdoing or asking for and receiving forgiveness, letting go of bitterness and resentment, or taking responsibility for living in gratitude, and so on and so on. You've heard me mention this before, but a great book to read this summer is The Wounded Heart, or I'm sorry, The Wounded Healer by Henry Nouwen. Sorry about that. It's The Wounded Healer by Henry Nouwen. In it, he states that people, somewhere around 74%, are often compelled to go into helping professions because they understand themselves also as being wounded. And I'm going to take this observation one step further and say that people not only see themselves as wounded, but perhaps they also know the power of transformative healing that takes place in themselves and the effect it has on the rest of humanity. They see the transformation. They understand the transformation and, you know, in themselves, and they also recognize this potential transformative healing to take place in others. And admittedly, looking to others for approval and self-worth appears to be a natural part of developing a sense of who we are. I mean, this behavior is often how we first learned about ourselves and others in the world. And families and teachers and other, let's say, childhood authority figures reflect, you know, their own views and mirror these perceptions back to us. Okay. But as a part of our human development, we have this potential in us early on, because long before we could form words, we are so skilled at reading facial prompts or sensing another's approval or disapproval, or we may recognize tones of love and laughter and anger and contempt. We could distinguish between a loving touch or a cold detachment and learning every other emotion in between. But sometime around 3 months of age, somewhere around there, we begin to engage in these face-to-face interactions with our caregivers, which is social referencing, you know, as it were. And as infants, we display, you know, the visual, facial, and vocal behaviors in response to how we're being treated through a kind of give-and-take exchange between ourselves and others, you know, which helps us to typically understand different situations. You know, this is why we learn, like, this is how we act at a funeral, or this is how we act at a ball game, or this is how we act at a restaurant, or, you know, whatever the situation is, whatever the context is. We learn to read the room by learning to read the expressions of others. Okay? And we hold these initial interactions in our physical bodies as we develop a sense of trust and safety, or suspicion and distrust. And again, this is all before we can form words. We are so gifted at picking up these things, you know, instinctively. Because, you know, from these early stages of infancy, we learn to regulate our affect, our emotions, as we take our social cues from people around us, you know, how to express our feelings appropriately, as well as when and where such emotions are to be displayed. But, you know, as we physically and emotionally mature, we must learn to become less dependent on others for this, let's say, affirmation. And we have to learn to replace it with an internalized or individual sense of who we are. So, in plain terms, instead of looking externally to get what we need in terms of approval and acceptance, we now look within to find such qualities such as resiliency and peace and self-love and so forth. And nevertheless, I think we also need to keep in mind that just as we initially look to others for our sense of affirmation and our sense of belonging and our sense of acceptance, so too are others looking to us to receive their sense of affirmation, belonging, and acceptance. And at first glance, this exchange appears to be mutually beneficial. However, taken to the extreme, it can also lead to codependency in all of our relationships. Okay, so let's just throw out an example here that codependency is typically seen in a very unhealthy relationship, personal or professional, whereby a person supports or enables another person's addiction or poor mental health or immaturity or irresponsibility or insecurity or underachievement, just to name a few things. Okay. And perhaps the most common theme in codependency itself is this excessive reliance on others for our approval and sense of identity. Okay, the most common theme in codependency is this excessive reliance on another person's for our approval and sense of identity. And seeing the previous hurt and the pain and so forth in another, you know, helps us to understand why the person is perhaps the way that they are. You know, seeing and understanding their history of events or their circumstances that may have shaped them and may have filled them with fear and pain and bitterness, and that can move us to forgive them more easily and help them to begin their process of telling their stories differently. Okay. What has so happened in the life of another person that allows them to act out and hurt and wound others and then act like nothing's wrong? What so happened in that person's life that allows them to do that? What has so happened in our lives that we might even think that we can convince ourselves that it's okay to act the way we do and cause another person pain and suffering and walk away like it's no big deal? What needs to heal in us? What needs to heal in them? And so forth. Okay. So even when we have an opportunity to forgive and to reconcile with one who has caused us great pain and suffering, and vice versa, we don't get off scot-free either, you know. So whenever we have this opportunity to forgive, you know, and that's present, because bitterness has so entangled our soul, let's say, it's often impossible to let go of pain. And, you know, you hear the stories out there. You know the teachings, the understanding that comes from society that, you know, there's huge belief that to let go of bitterness, well, that's just simply a sign of weakness. And, you know, but all in all, sometimes both the victim and the survivor and offenders cannot envision taking hold of something better. You know, it's just a too vulnerable place for them to go. And although each person walks their own path in this life, embracing forgiveness and healing and grace and love occurs as each person is ready. Nobody can do this for another. So in other words, the door of healing can be shown, but one must turn the key and walk through. Well, I'm Dr. James Houck, and you've been listening to Reclaiming Authenticity. Thank you for spending this time with me. And like I said, if you want to go back into the archives, just please do so. Just visit the website and you'll find the archives there. And you can go back and listen to any broadcast that you might have missed. You can just pull it up and listen to it anytime. So again, I just encourage you to drop me a line. Tell me what you thought of tonight's broadcast as well as the others. And in the meantime, until we meet again, till we talk again, may God always hold us in the palm of God's hands. Take care and God bless. Thank you.
for an answer, or just to leave 1,000 comments, or prodding around to buy a book by Dr. Hauk. It's all there. Just wander over to ReclaimingAuthenticity.com and click around. And we'll see you next Wednesday at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, 6 p.m. Pacific, on BBS Radio TV.